That night, Connor and the Admiral have a secret meeting in his quarters, drinking coffee made by a machine rumored to be broken. They speak of Roland and Connor's suspicions about him, but the Admiral is not satisfied.
"I don't want suspicion, I want proof. I don't want your feelings, I want evidence."
The Admiral adds some whiskey from a flask to his own coffee. When Connor is done with his report, he gets up to leave, but the Admiral won't let him. He pours Connor a second cup of coffee, which will surely keep him up all night, but then he doubts he'll be sleeping well tonight anyway.
"Very few people know what I'm about to tell you," says the Admiral.
"So why tell me?"
"Because it serves my purposes for you to know."
It's an honest answer, but one that still keeps his motives hidden. Connor imagines he must have been very good in a war.
"When I was much younger," begins the Admiral, "I fought in the Heartland War. The scars you so impertinently assumed were transplant scars came from a grenade."
"Which side were you on?"
The Admiral gives Connor that scrutinizing look he's so good at. "How much do you know about the Heartland War?"
Connor shrugs. "It was the last chapter in our history textbook, but we had state testing, so we never got to it." The Admiral waves his hand in disgust.
"Textbook sugarcoated anyway. No one wants to remember how it really was. You ask which side I was on? The truth is, there were three sides in the war, not two. There was the Life Army, the Choice Brigade, and the remains of the American military, whose job it was to keep the other two sides from killing each other. That's the side I was on. Unfortunately, we weren't very successful. You see, a conflict always begins with an issue, a difference of opinion, an argument. But by the time it turns into a war, the issue doesn't matter anymore, because now it's about one thing and one thing only, how much each side hates the other."
The Admiral pours a little more whiskey into his mug before he continues.
"There were dark days leading up to the war. Everything that we think defines right and wrong was being turned upside down. On one side, people were murdering abortion doctors to protect the right to life, while on the other side, people were getting pregnant just to sell their fetal tissue. And everyone was selecting their leaders not by their ability to lead, but by where they stood on this single issue. It was beyond madness. Then the military fractured, both sides got hold of weapons of war, and two opinions became two armies determined to destroy each other. And then came the Bill of Life."
The mention of it sends ice water down Connor's spine. It never used to bother him, but things change once you become an unwind.
"I was right there in the room when they came up with the idea that a pregnancy could be terminated retroactively once a child reaches the age of reason," says the Admiral. "At first, it was a joke. No one intended it to be taken seriously. But that same year, the Nobel Prize went to a scientist who perfected neurografting, a technique that allows every part of a donor to be used in transplant."
The Admiral takes a deep gulp of his coffee. Connor hasn't had a bit of his second cup. The thought of swallowing anything right now is out of the question. It's all he can do to keep the first cup down.
"With the war getting worse," says the Admiral, "we brokered a peace by bringing both sides to the table. Then we proposed the idea of unwinding, which would terminate unwanteds without actually ending their lives. We thought it would shock both sides into seeing reason, that they would stare at each other across the table and someone would blink. But nobody blinked. The choice to terminate without ending life, it satisfied the needs of both sides. The Bill of Life was signed, the Unwind Accord went into effect, and the war was over. Everyone was so happy to end the war, no one cared about the consequences."
The Admiral's thoughts go far away for a moment, and he waves his hand.
"I'm sure you know the rest."
Connor might not know all the particulars, but he knows the gist. "People wanted parts."
"Demanded is more like it. A cancerous colon could be replaced with a healthy new one. An accident victim who would have died from internal injuries could get fresh organs. A wrinkled arthritic hand could be replaced by one 50 years younger, and all those new parts had to come from somewhere."
The Admiral paused for a moment to consider it.
"Of course, if more people had been organ donors, unwinding never would have happened."
but people like to keep what's theirs, even after they're dead. It didn't take long for ethics to be crushed by greed. Unwinding became big business, and people let it happen. The Admiral glances over at the picture of his son. Even without the Admiral telling him, Connor realizes why, but allows the Admiral the dignity of his confession.
My son, Arlen, was a great kid. Smart. But he was troubled. You know the type.
I am the type, says Connor, offering a slight grin. The Admiral nods.
It was just about 10 years ago. He got in with the wrong group of friends, got caught stealing. Hell, I was the same at his age. That's why my parents first sent me to military school to straighten me out. Only for Harlan there was a different option. A more efficient option.
You had him unwound.
As one of the fathers of the Unwind Accord, I was expected to set an example.
He presses his thumb and forefinger against his eyes, stemming off tears before they can flow.
We signed the order, then changed our minds, but it was already too late. They had taken Harlan right out of school to the harvest camp and rushed him through. It had already been done.
It had never occurred to Connor to consider the toll unwinding had on the ones who signed the order. He never thought he could have sympathy for a parent who could do that, or sympathy for one of the men who had made unwinding possible.
I'm sorry, Connor says, and means it.
The Admiral stiffens up, sobers up almost instantly.
You shouldn't be. It's only because of his unwinding that you're all here. Afterward, my wife left me and formed a foundation in Harlan's memory. I left the military, spent several years more drunk than I am now, and then, 3 years ago, I had the big idea. This place, these kids, are the result of it. To date, I've saved more than 1,000 kids from unwinding.
Connor now understands why the Admiral was telling him these things. It was more than just a confession. It was a way of securing Connor's loyalty, and it worked. The Admiral was a darkly obsessed man, but his obsession saved lives. Hayden once said that Connor had integrity. That same integrity locks him firmly on the Admiral's side, and so Connor holds up his mug. To Harlan, he says.
To Harlan,
echoes the Admiral, and together they drink to his name.
Bit by bit I am making things right, Connor,
the Admiral says.
Bit by bit, and in more ways than one.
35. Lev. Where Lev was between the time he left Sci-Fi and his arrival at the graveyard is less important than where his thoughts resided. They resided in places colder and darker than the many places he hid. He had survived the month through a string of unpleasant compromises and crimes of convenience, whatever was necessary to keep himself alive. Lev quickly became street smart and survival wise. They say it takes complete immersion in a culture to learn its language and its ways. It didn't take him very long to learn the language of the lost. Once he landed in the Safe House network, he quickly made it known that he was not a guy to be trifled with. He didn't tell people he was a tithe. Instead, he told them his parents signed the order to have him unwound after he was arrested for armed robbery. It was funny to him, because he had never even touched a gun. It amazed him that the other kids couldn't read the lie in his face. He'd always been such a bad liar. But then, when he looked in the mirror, what he saw in his own eyes scared him. By the time he reached the graveyard, most kids knew enough to stay away from him, which is exactly what he wanted. The same night that the Admiral and Connor have their secret conference, Lev heads out into the oil-slick dark of the moonless night, keeping his flashlight off. His first night there, he had successfully slipped out to find Connor in order to set him straight about a few things. Since then, the bruise from Connor's punch has faded, and they haven't spoken of it again. He hasn't spoken much to Connor at all, because Lev has other things on his mind. Each night since then, he's tried to sneak away, but every time he's been caught and sent back. Now that the Admiral's 5 watchdogs have left, though, the kids on sentry duty are getting lax. As Lev sneaks between the jets, he finds that a few of them are even asleep on the job. Stupid of the Admiral to send those other kids away without having anyone to replace them. Once he's far enough away, he turns on his flashlight and tries to find his destination. It's a destination told to him by a girl he had encountered a few weeks before. She was very much like him. He suspects he'll meet others tonight who are very much like him as well. Aisle 30, space 12. It's about as far from the Admiral as you can get and still be in the graveyard. The space is occupied by an ancient DC-10, crumbling to pieces in its final resting place. When Lev swings open the hatch and climbs in, he finds two kids inside, both of whom bolt upright at the sight of him and take defensive postures.
"My name's Lev," he says. "I was told to come here."
He doesn't know these kids, but that's no surprise. He hasn't been in the graveyard long enough to know that many kids here. One is an Asian girl with pink hair. The other kid has a shaved head and is covered in tattoos.
"And who told you to come here?" asks the fleshhead.
"This girl I met in Colorado. Her name's Julianne."
Then a third figure comes out from the shadows. It's not a kid, but an adult, mid-20s maybe. He's smiling. The guy has greasy red hair, a straggly goatee to match, and a bony face with sunken cheeks. It's Cleaver, the helicopter pilot.
"So, Julianne sent you," he says. "Cool. How is she?"
Lev takes a moment to think about his answer.
"She did her job," Lev tells him.
Cleaver nods.
"Well, it is what it is."
The other two kids introduce themselves. The flesh head is Blaine. The girl is Mai.
"What about the buff who flies the helicopter with you?" Lev asks Cleaver. "Is he part of this too?"
Mai gives a disgusted laugh.
"Roland? Not on your life."
"Roland isn't exactly the material for our little group," Cleaver says. "So, did you come here to give us the good news about Julianne? Or are you here for another reason?"
"I'm here because I want to be here."
"You say it," says Cleaver. "But we still don't know you're for real."
"Tell us about yourself," says Mai.
Lev prepares to give them the armed robbery version, but before he opens his mouth, he changes his mind. The moment calls for honesty. This must begin with the truth. So he tells them everything. From the moment he was kidnapped by Connor, to his time with Sci-Fi and the weeks after that. When he's done, Cleaver seems very, very pleased.
"So you're a tithe! That's great! You don't even know how great that is!"
"What now?" asks Lev. "Am I in or not?"
The others become quiet, serious. He feels some sort of ritual is about to begin.
"Tell me, Lev," says Cleaver, "how much do you hate the people who are going to unwind you?"
"A lot."
"Sorry, that's not good enough."
Lev closes his eyes, digs down, and thinks about his parents. He thinks about what they planned to do to him, and how they made him actually want it.
"How much do you hate them?"
Cleaver asks again.
"Totally and completely," answers Lev.
"And how much do you hate the people who would take parts of you and make them parts of themselves?"
"Totally and completely."
"And how much do you want to make them and everyone else in the world pay?"
"Totally and completely."
Someone has to pay for the unfairness of it all. Everyone has to pay. He'll make them.
"Good," says Cleaver.
Lev is amazed by the depth of his own fury, but he's becoming less and less frightened of it. He tells himself that's a good thing.
"Maybe he's for real," says Blaine.
If Lev makes this commitment, he knows there's no turning back.
"One thing I need to know," Lev asks, "because Julianne, she wasn't very clear about it. I want to know what you believe."
"What we believe?" says Mai. She looks at Blaine and Blaine laughs. Cleaver, however, puts his hand up to quiet them.
No, it's a good question. A real question. It deserves a real answer. If you're asking if we have a cause, we don't. So get that out of your head."
Cleaver gestures broadly, his hands and arms filling the space around him.
causes are old news. We believe in randomness, earthquakes, tornadoes. We believe in forces of nature, and we are forces of nature. We are havoc. We're chaos. We mess with the world.
We messed pretty good with the Admiral, didn't we? Says Blaine slyly. Cleaver throws him a sharp gaze, and Mai actually looks scared. It's almost enough to give Lev second thoughts.
How did you mess with the Admiral?
It's done, says Mai, her body language both anxious and angry. We messed, and now it's done. We don't talk about things that are done, right?
Cleaver gives her a nod, and she seems to relax a bit.
The point is, says Cleaver, it doesn't matter who or what we mess with, just as long as we mess. The way we see it, the world doesn't move if things don't get shaken up. Am I right?
I guess.
Well, then we are the movers and shakers.
Cleaver smiles and points a finger at Lev.
The question is, are you one too? Do you have what it takes to be one of us?
Lev takes a long look at these three. These are the kinds of people his parents would hate. He could join them just out of spite, but that's not enough, not this time. There must be more. Yet, as he stands there, Lev realizes that there is more. It's invisible, but it's there, like the deadly charge lurking in a downed power line. Anger, but not just anger, a will to act on it as well.
All right. I'm in.
Back at home, Lev always felt part of something larger than himself. Until now, he hadn't realized how much he missed that feeling.
Welcome to the family, says Cleaver, and gives him a slap on the back so painful he sees stars.
36. Risa. Risa is the first to notice something's wrong with Connor. Risa is the first to care that something's wrong with Lev. In a moment of selfishness, she finds herself aggravated by it, because things are going so well for her now. She finally has a place to be. She wishes this could remain her sanctuary beyond her 18th birthday, because in the outside world she'd never be able to do the things she's doing now. It would be practicing medicine without a license. Fine when you're in survival mode, but not in the civilized world. Perhaps, after she turned 18, she could go to college and medical school. But that takes money, connections, and she'd have to face even more competition than in her music classes. She wonders if maybe she could join the military and become an army medic. You don't have to be a buff to be in a medical unit. Whatever her choice ends up being, the important thing is that there could be a choice. For the first time in a long time, she can see a future for herself. With all these good thoughts in her life, the last thing she wants is something that will shoot it all down. This is what fills Risa's mind as she makes her way to one of the study jets. The Admiral has three of his most accessible and well-appointed jets set aside as study spaces, complete with libraries, computers, and the resources to learn anything you want to learn.
It is not a school, the Admiral told them shortly after they arrived. There are no teachers, there are no exams.
Oddly, it's precisely that lack of expectation that keeps the study jets full most of the time. Risa's duties start shortly after dawn, and it has become her habit to begin her day at one of the study jets, since at that time of the morning she's usually the only one there. She likes it that way, because the things she wants to learn make other kids uncomfortable. It's not the subject matter that bothers them, it's the fact that Risa's the one studying it. Anatomy and medical texts, mostly. Kids assume that just because she works in the medical jet, she knows all there is to know. It disturbs them to see her actually having to learn it. When she arrives today, however, she discovers Connor already there. She stops at the hatch, surprised. He's so absorbed in whatever he's reading that he doesn't hear her come in. She takes a moment to look at him. She's never seen him so tired, not even when they were on the run. Still, she's thrilled to see him. They have both been so busy, there hasn't been much time to spend together.
Hi, Connor.
Startled, he looks up quickly and slams his book closed. When he realizes who it is, he relaxes.
Hi, Risa.
By the time she sits down beside him, he's smiling, and doesn't seem quite so tired. She's glad she can have that kind of effect on him.
You're up early. No, I'm up late, he says. I couldn't sleep, so I came here.
He glances out one of the little round windows.
Is it morning already?
Just about.
What are you reading?
He tries to push it out of view, but it's too late for that. He has two books out. The bottom volume is a book on engineering. That's no surprise, considering the interest he's taken in the way things work. It's the book on top, the one his nose was in when she arrived, that catches her by surprise, almost making her laugh.
Criminology for morons?
Yeah, well, everybody needs a hobby. She tries to take a long look into him, but he looks away.
There's something wrong, isn't there? She asks.
I don't need to read Connor for morons to know that you're in some kind of trouble. He looks everywhere but into her eyes.
It isn't trouble. At least not for me.
Or maybe it is in some ways. I don't know.
Want to talk about it?
That, says Connor, is the last thing I want to do. He takes a deep breath and shifts in his chair.
Don't worry. Everything will be fine.
You don't sound too sure. He looks at Risa, then looks at the hatch, making sure they're still alone. Then he leans in close to her and says,
Now that the Goldens are no longer around, the Admiral's going to be looking for replacements. I want you to promise me that if he asks you to help him, you'll turn him down.
The Admiral doesn't even know I exist. Why would he ask me for anything?
Because he asked me, Connor says in an intense whisper. And I think he's asked Emby, too.
Emby?
All I'm saying is that I don't want you to be a target.
A target for what? For whom?
Shh, keep your voice down.
She looks again at the book he was reading, trying to piece it all together. But there just aren't enough pieces. She gets close to him, forcing him to look at her.
I want to help you, she says. I'm worried about you. Please, let me help you.
He darts his eyes back and forth, trying to find an escape from her gaze, but he can't. Suddenly, he bridges the small distance between them and kisses her. She did not expect it, and when he breaks off the kiss, she realizes from the look on his face that he hadn't expected it either.
What was that for?
Takes a moment for him to get his brain functioning again.
That, he says, is in case something happens and I don't see you again.
Fine, she says, and she pulls him into another kiss, this one longer than the first. When she breaks it off, she says,
That's in case I do see you again.
He leaves, awkwardly stumbling out and nearly falling down the steel steps to the ground. In spite of all that just went on between them, Risa has to smile. It's amazing that something as simple as a kiss can overpower the worst of worries. Lev's troubles appear to be of a different nature, and Risa finds herself frightened by him. He comes to infirmary call that morning with a bad sunburn. Since he's a fast runner, he's been assigned messenger duty. Mostly it involves running back and forth between the jets carrying notes. It's one of the Admiral's rules that all messengers wear sunscreen, but it seems Lev is no longer bound by anyone's rules. They make small talk for a bit, but it's awkward, so she quickly gets down to business.
Well, now your hair is longer, at least your forehead and neck seem to have been spared. Take off your shirt.
I kept my shirt on most of the time, he says.
Let's have a look anyway.
Reluctantly, he removes his shirt. He's burned there as well, but not as badly as on his arms and cheeks. What catches her attention, however, is a welt on his back in the faint shape of a hand. She brushes her fingers across it.
Who did this to you?
She asks.
Nobody,
he says, grabbing the shirt back from her and slipping it on.
Just some guy. Is someone on your team giving you trouble?
I told you it's nothing. What are you, my mother?
No, says Risa. If I were your mother, I'd be rushing you off to the nearest Tarvis camp.
She means it as a joke, but Lev doesn't find it funny.
Just give me something to put on the burns.
There's a deadness to his voice that's haunting. She goes to the cabinet and finds a tube of aloe cream, but she doesn't hand it to him just yet.
I miss the old Lev, she says.
That makes him look at her.
No offense, but you didn't even know me.
Maybe not, but at least back then I wanted to.
And you don't want to anymore?
I don't know, says Risa,
The kid I'm looking at now is a little too creepy for my taste.
She can tell that gets to him. She doesn't know why it should, because he seems proud of his new creep factor.
The old Lev, he says, tricked you into trusting him, then turned you into the police the first chance he got.
And the new Lev wouldn't do that?
He thinks about it, then says, the new Lev has better things to do.
She puts the tube of burn cream in his hand.
Yeah, well, if you see the old one, the one who always thought about God and his purpose and stuff, tell him we want him back.
There's an uneasy silence, and he looks down at the tube in his hand. For a moment, she thinks he might say something that brings a hint of that other kid back into the room. But all he says is,
how often do I put this on?
There's a work call the following day. Risa hates them, because she knows there isn't going to be anything for her. But everyone must attend work call. Today, the gathering isn't run by an unwind. It's run by Cleaver. Apparently, he's temporarily taken over the job, since no one's been found to fulfill Amp's duties. Risa doesn't like him. He's got an unpleasant, slimy look about him. There are only a few calls for work today. Someone wants a plumber's assistant in some godforsaken town named Beaver's Breath. There's some farm work out in California, and the third job is just plain weird.
Prudho Bay, Alaska, Cleaver says. You'll be working on an oil pipeline until you're 18. From what I hear, it's one of the coldest, most brutal places on Earth. But hey, it's a way out, right? I need 3 volunteers.
The first hand up belongs to an older kid who looks like Punishment is his middle name. Like he was born for brutal work, right down to his shaved head. The second hand raised catches Risa by surprise. It's Mai. What is Mai doing volunteering for work on a pipeline? Why would she leave the boy she was so attached to back in the warehouse? But then, come to think of it, Risa hasn't seen that boy around the graveyard at all. While she tries to process this, a third hand goes up. It's a younger kid, a smaller kid, a kid with a bad sunburn. Lev's hand is held high, and he gets chosen for the pipeline job. Risa just stands there in disbelief. Then she searches for Connor in the crowd. He's seen it too. He looks at Risa and shrugs. Well, maybe this is just a shrug to Connor. But it's not to her. When the meeting breaks up, she makes a beeline for Lev, but he's already vanished into the mob. So the instant Risa gets back to the infirmary, she calls for a messenger, and another, sending them each off with redundant notes reminding kids to take their medications. Finally, after her fourth call, the messenger they send is Lev. He must see the look on her face because he just stands there at the hatch not coming in. One of the other medics is there, so Risa glares at Lev, pointing toward the back.
That way, now.
I don't take orders, he says. That way, she says again, even more forcefully. Now! Apparently he does take orders after all, because he steps in and marches toward the back of the plane. Once they reach the storage room at the back, she closes the bulkhead door behind them and lays into him.
What the hell are you thinking?
His face is steel. It's the door of a safe she can't get into.
I've never been to Alaska, he says. Might as well go now.
You've barely been here for a week. Why are you in such a hurry to leave? And for a job like that?
I don't have to explain anything to you or anyone else. I raised my hand, I got chosen, and that's all.
Risa crosses her arms in defiance of his defiance.
You don't go anywhere if I don't give you a clean bill of health. I could tell the Admiral you've got infectious hepatitis.
You wouldn't.
Just watch me.
He storms away from her, kicking the wall in fury, then storms back.
He won't believe you, and even if he does, you can't keep me sick forever.
Why are you so determined to go?
There are things I have to do, Lev says. I don't expect you to understand. I'm sorry I'm not who you want me to be, but I've changed. I'm not that same stupid, naive kid you guys kidnapped 2 months ago. Nothing you can do will keep me from leaving here and doing what I've got to do.
Risa says nothing, because she knows he's right. She can stall him at best, but she can't stop him.
So, says Lev a bit more calmly now, do I have infectious hepatitis or not?
She sighs.
No, you don't.
He turns to leave, opening the bulkhead door. He's so determined to move on, he doesn't even think to offer her a goodbye.
You're wrong about one thing, she says before he's out the door. You're just as naive as you were before, and maybe twice as stupid.
Then he's gone. That same afternoon, an unmarked white van comes to take him, Mai, and the fleshhead away. Once again, Risa thinks she'll never see Lev again. Once again, she'll be wrong. 37. Emby and the Admiral. Emby has no idea of all the gears turning in the graveyard, or even that he's one of them. His world is contained within the square panels of his comic books and the well-defined borders of a pinball machine. Staying within those borders has been a successful defense against the injustice and cruelty of life outside of them. He does not question the oddness of the trio that just left for Alaska. It's not his business. He does not sense the tension in Connor. Connor can take care of himself. He does not spend time wondering about Roland. He just stays out of Roland's way. But keeping his head down does not keep him in the safe zone. Emby is, in fact, the central bumper on the pinball board, and every single ball in play is about to rebound off of him. The Admiral has called for him. Emby now stands nervously at the entrance to what was once the mobile command center for the President of the United States. There are two other men here. They are in white shirts and dark ties. The black sedan that waits at the bottom of the stairs must be theirs. The Admiral sits at his desk. Emby tries to decide whether he should enter or turn around and run away. But the Admiral sees him, and his gaze freezes Emby's feet in place.
You wanted me, sir?
Yes. Have a seat, Zachary.
He forces his feet to move toward the chair across from the Admiral.
Emby, he says. Everyone just calls me Emby. Is that your choice or theirs? Asks the Admiral.
Well, theirs mostly. But I got used to it.
Never let anyone else name you, says the Admiral.
He leafs through a file with Emby's picture clipped to the cover. It's a full file, and Emby can't imagine how there could be enough interesting things in his life to fill a file that thick.
You may not realize this, but you're a very special boy, says the Admiral.
Emby can only look down at his shoelaces, which are, as always, moments away from coming untied.
Is that why I'm here, sir? Because I'm special?
Yes, Zachary. And because of it, you're going to be leaving us today.
Emby looks up.
What?
There's someone who wants to meet you. In fact, it's someone who's been looking for you for a very long time.
Really?
These men will take you there.
Who is it?
Emby has a long-standing fantasy that one of his parents is actually still alive. If not his mother, then his father. He has always dreamed that his father was actually a spy. That his death all those years ago was just the official story, and he's been off in the untamed corners of the world fighting evil, like a real-life comic book hero.
It's no one you know, says the Admiral, dashing Emby's hopes. She's a good woman, though. Actually, she's my ex-wife.
I don't understand.
It'll be clear to you soon enough, don't worry.
Which, to Emby, is an open invitation to worry without end. It makes him start to hyperventilate, which makes his bronchial tubes begin to constrict. He starts to wheeze. The Admiral looks at him with concern.
Are you all right?
Asthma,
Emby says between wheezes. He pulls out an inhaler from his pocket and takes a puff.
Yes, says the Admiral. My son had asthma. He responded very well to Zolair.
He looks up at one of the men behind Emby.
Please make sure you get some Zolair for that lung.
Yes, Admiral Dunphy.
It takes a moment for this to bounce around on the pegs and pins in Emby's mind before hitting his mental flippers.
Dunphy? Your last name is Dunphy?
We have no last names in the graveyard, says the Admiral.
Then he stands and grabs Emby's hand, shaking it.
Goodbye, Zachary. When you see my ex-wife, give her my regards.
Emby can only squeak a wordless response as the men take him by the arms and lead him out and down toward the waiting sedan. Once the boy is gone, Admiral Dunphy leans back in his chair. With all the things threatening his domain, here's one thing he can be pleased with. He allows himself a brief moment of satisfaction, glancing over at the smiling picture of his son Harlan, better known as Humphrey in modern folklore. But those who loved him know his real name. Yes, the Admiral is redeeming himself and setting things right, bit by bit by bit. 38. Mob. Emby's disappearance goes undiscovered for almost 2 days, until someone takes a look at the pinball machine and notices that something is missing. Where's the mouth breather? People begin to ask. It's not until nightfall that people start asking seriously, and by morning, it's clear that he's gone. Some people claim they saw him wandering off into the desert. Some people claim there was a mysterious car that took him away. Ralphie Sherman claims he saw Emby beamed up to the mothership to be with his own kind. Every suggestion is mulled over. Every theory is entertained. A search is mounted by Emby's team. It turns up nothing. Through all of this, the Admiral is silent. Now Emby, the kid at the bottom of the pecking order, has suddenly become everyone's best friend, and his disappearance fuel for everyone's fire. Roland uses it to further his own agenda of fear. After all, he was the one who very publicly predicted that Emby would vanish. He didn't believe it for an instant, but now that his prediction has come true, he has everyone's attention. You watch, Roland tells all those who will listen. The Admiral's going to show up one of these days with a nice thick head of Emby hair hidden beneath his hat. And any one of us could be next. Has he been looking at your eyes? Has he been listening to the sound of your voice? If he wants a part of you, you'll end up just like Emby. He's so convincing, he almost believes it himself. Connor has a completely different view of the situation. He's certain that Roland did away with Emby so he could use his disappearance to gather support. For Connor, it's more proof that Roland killed the Goldens, that he'll stop at nothing to get what he wants. Connor brings his suspicions to the Admiral. He listens, but still says nothing. The Admiral knows that claiming responsibility for Emby's absence would play right into the mania that Roland is creating. The Admiral could tell Connor that he was the one who sent the boy away, but that would beg questions that he has no desire to answer. He decides to let Connor think that Roland did it. It would motivate Connor even more to find that crucial link connecting Roland to the murders, because now the Admiral has come to believe in Roland's guilt as well. Forget the missing boy, he tells Connor. Concentrate on proving Roland killed the others. Someone must have helped him. Someone must know. Right now, Roland has too many supporters. We can't take him down without hard evidence. Then somehow I'll get you evidence, Connor tells him. I'll do it for Emby. After Connor leaves the Admiral's jet, the Admiral sits alone, pondering the ins and outs of the situation. Things in the graveyard have gotten dicey before, but dicey situations have always been the Admiral's specialty. He's sure he can play this one to a successful conclusion and get everything back under his control. As he sits there in his jet, he gets an ache in his shoulder that spreads down to his arm. No doubt it's another manifestation of his various war wounds. He calls for a medic to bring him some aspirin. 39. Roland. Roland opens the envelope that Hayden has just handed him and reads the note inside. I know what you did. I'll make you a deal. Meet me at the FedEx jet. The note isn't signed, but it doesn't have to be. Roland knows who sent it. Connor's the only one with nerve enough to blackmail him. The only one stupid enough. The note sets Roland's mind spinning. I know what you did. There are quite a lot of activities Connor could be talking about. He might know that Roland has been sabotaging the generators so he can blame the Admiral for outrageous living conditions. Or he might know about the bottle of Ipecac he stole from the infirmary while pretending to flirt with Risa. He was planning to use the stuff to spike the drinks, create a puke fest, and then blame the Admiral for giving them all food poisoning. Yes, There are plenty of things Connor could have found out about. Roland puts the note in his pocket, showing no emotion, and glares at Hayden.
So you're Connor's messenger boy now.
Hey, says Hayden. I'm Switzerland, neutral as can be, and also good with chocolate.
Get lost,
Roland tells him. Already am, and Hayden strolls away. It burns Roland that he might have to bargain with Connor, but there are worse things. And after all, bargains and subterfuge are a way of life for him. So he heads off toward the FedEx jet, making sure he takes a knife with him, in case there's no deal to be made. 40. Connor.
I'm here, Roland calls from outside the FedEx jet. What do you want?
Connor remains hidden inside the hold. He knows he's only going to get one chance at this, so he's got to do it right.
Come inside and we'll talk about it.
No, you come out.
Nice try, Connor thinks, but this is going to be on my terms. If you don't come in, I'll tell everyone what I know. I'll show everyone what I found.
Silence for a moment. Then he sees Roland's silhouette as he climbs into the hold.
Connor has the advantage now. His eyes have adjusted to the dim light of the hold, and Roland's have not. He leaps forward and firmly plants the muzzle of the Admiral's gun against Roland's back.
Don't move.
Instinctively, Roland's hands go up, as if he's been in this position many times before.
Is this your deal?
Shut up. Connor uses one hand to frisk him, finds the concealed knife, and hurls it out of the cargo hold. Satisfied, he pushes the gun harder against Roland.
Move.
Where am I supposed to go?
You know where to go. Crate 2933. Move.
Roland begins to walk forward, squeezing between the narrow rows of crates. Connor is conscious of every movement of Roland's body. Even with a gun to his back, Roland is arrogant and sure of himself.
You don't want to kill me, he says. Everyone here likes me. If you do anything to me, they'll tear you apart.
They reach crate 2933. Get in, Connor says. That's when Roland makes his move. He spins, knocks Connor back, and grabs for the gun. Connor expected this. He holds the gun out of reach, and using the crate behind him for leverage, places his foot firmly in Roland's gut and pushes him back. Roland falls backward into crate 2933. The second he does, Connor lurches forward, slams the hatch, and seals it. While Roland rages inside, Connor takes aim at the crate and fires the gun once, twice, three times. The blasts echo, blending with the terrified screams from within the crate, and then Roland shouts,
"What are you doing? Are you insane?"
Connor's shots have been very precise. They were low and directed at a corner of the crate. "I've given you something your victims never had," Connor tells him. "I've given you air holes." Then he sits down. "Now we talk." 41. Mob. Half a mile away, a search party returns from the desert. They didn't find Emby. Instead, they found five unmarked graves behind a distant outcropping of rocks. In a few short minutes, word spreads through the ranks like flames in a steady wind. The Goldens have been found, and apparently they weren't so golden after all. Someone suggests that the Admiral did it himself. The suggestion becomes a rumor, and the rumor quickly becomes accepted as fact. The Admiral killed his own. He's everything Roland says he is. And hey, where is Roland? He's missing too? So is Connor. What has the Admiral done to them? A mob of unwinds with 100 reasons to be angry have all simultaneously found one more, and that's all it takes to push them over the edge. The mob storms toward the Admiral's jet, picking up more and more kids along the way. 42. Risa. A few minutes earlier, Risa had responded to the Admiral's request and showed up at his jet with some aspirin. She was greeted by the Admiral, who, as she had told Connor, didn't even know her name. Now he chats with her, telling her that the experience she's getting here is better than what anyone her age gets in the outside world. She tells him of her thoughts of becoming an army medic, and he seems pleased. He complains of shoulder pain and asks her for the aspirin. She gives it to him, but just to be on the safe side, she checks his blood pressure, and he applauds her for being so thorough. There's some sort of commotion outside that makes it hard for her to focus on taking the Admiral's blood pressure. Commotion is not unusual here. Whatever it is, Risa suspects it will end with bandages and ice packs for someone. Her work is never done. 43. Mob. Furious kids begin to arrive at the Admiral's jet.
Get him! Get him! Pull him out!
They climb the steel steps. The hatch is open, but just a crack. Risa looks out at the wave of mayhem, like a human tsunami pounding toward her.
He's got a girl in there with him!
The first of the kids reaches the top of the stairs and heaves the hatch open, only to be met by Risa and a brutal punch to the jaw. It sends him tumbling over the side and to the ground, but there's more where he came from.
Don't let her close that door!
The second kid is met by an aerosol burst of Bactine right to his eyes. The pain is excruciating. He stumbles backward into the other kids coming up the stairs, and they tumble like dominoes. Risa grabs the hatch, swings it closed, and seals it from the inside. Kids are on the wings now, finding every piece of loose metal and prying it up. It's amazing how much of a plane can be shredded by bare-handed fury.
Break the windows! Pull them out!
Kids on the ground throw rocks that hit their comrades as often as they hit the jet. On the inside, it sounds like a hailstorm. The Admiral blanches at the scene outside the windows. His heart races. His shoulder and arm ache.
How did this happen? How did I let this happen?
The barrage of stones batters the fuselage, but nothing breaks the armored steel. Nothing cracks the bulletproof glass of the former Air Force One. Then someone tears out the power line connecting the jet to its generator. The lights go out, the air conditioning shuts down, and the entire jet quickly begins to bake in the broiling sun. 44. Connor. You murdered Amp, Jeeves, and the rest of the Goldens.
You're crazy!
Connor sits outside Crate 2933, wiping his brow in the heat. Roland's voice comes from inside, muffled, but loud enough to hear.
You got rid of them so you could take their place, Connor says.
I swear, when I get out of here, I'll...
You'll what? You'll kill me like you killed them? Like you killed Emby?
No response from Roland. I said I'd make you a deal, says Connor, and I will. If you confess, I'll make sure the Admiral spares your life. In response, Roland suggests Connor perform a physical impossibility.
Confess, Roland. It's the only way I'm letting you out of there.
Connor is sure that, if put under enough pressure, Roland will confess to what he's done. The Admiral needs evidence, and what better evidence than a full confession?
I have nothing to confess to.
Fine, says Connor. I can wait. I have all day. 45. Mob. The fortress of the Admiral's jet is impenetrable. The temperature inside is soaring past 100. Risa's handling the heat, but the Admiral doesn't look too good. She still can't open the door because the mob is relentlessly trying to get in. Outside, whatever kids aren't swarming over the Admiral's jet are spreading out. If they can't get to the Admiral, then they'll destroy everything else. The study jets, the dormitory jets, even the recreation jet. Everything is being torn apart, and whatever can burn is set aflame. They are filled with an insatiable fury, and beneath it is a strange joy that the anger can finally be released. And beneath the joy is more fury. From halfway across the graveyard, Cleaver sees the smoke rising in the distance, beckoning him. Cleaver is drawn to mayhem. He must be a witness to it. He gets into his helicopter and flies toward the angry mob. He sets down as close to the chaos as he dares to get. Have his deeds in any way led to this? He hopes so. He turns off the engine, letting the blades slow so he can hear the wonderful sounds of havoc. Then the angry unwinds turn toward him.
It's Cleaver! He works for the Admiral!
Suddenly, Cleaver is the center of attention. He can't help but feel this is a good thing. 46. Connor. Roland is slowly breaking. He confesses to many things, petty acts of vandalism and theft, that Connor couldn't care less about. But this is going to work. It has to work. Connor has no other plan to bring him to justice. It has to work.
I've done a lot of things, Roland tells him through the three bullet holes in the crate, but I never killed anybody.
Connor just listens. He barely speaks to him anymore. Connor finds the less he speaks, the more Roland does.
How do you know they're even dead?
Because I buried them, me and the Admiral.
Then you did it,
says Roland.
You did it, and you're trying to make me take the blame.
Now Connor begins to see the flaw in his plan. If he lets Roland out without a confession, then he's a dead man. But he can't keep him in there forever. His options are now narrower than the spaces between the crates. Then a voice calls to them from outside. Is anyone there? Connor? Roland? Anybody? It's Hayden.
Help!
Screams Roland at the top of his lungs.
Help! He's crazy! Come in here and let me out!
But his screams don't make it out of the hold. Connor gets up and makes his way to the entrance. Hayden looks up at him. He's not his usual cool self, and there's a nasty bruise on his forehead, like he was hit by something.
Thank God! Connor, you gotta get back there! It's nuts! You gotta stop it! They'll listen to you!
What are you talking about?
The Admiral killed the Goldens, and then everyone thought he'd killed you!
The Admiral didn't kill anybody.
Well, try telling them that!
Them who?
Everybody! They're tearing the place apart!
Connor sees the far-off smoke, and he takes a quick glance back into the hold, deciding that, for the moment, Roland can wait. He hops down to the ground and races off with Hayden.
Tell me everything, from the beginning.
When Connor arrives at the scene, his mind keeps trying to reject what his eyes are telling him. He stares, part of him hoping the vision will go away. It's like the aftermath of some natural disaster. Broken bits of metal, glass, and wood are everywhere. Pages torn from books flutter past smashed electronics. Bonfires burn and kids hurl in more wreckage to feed the flames.
My God.
There's a group of jeering kids near the helicopter, gathered like a rugby scrum, kicking something in the center. Then Connor realizes it's not some thing, it's someone. He races in, pulling the kids apart. The kids who know Connor immediately back off, and the others follow suit. The man on the ground is battered and bloody. It's Cleaver. Connor kneels down and props up his head.
It's okay. You're going to be okay.
But even as he says it, Connor knows it's not true. He's been beaten to a pulp. Cleaver grimaces, his mouth bloody. Then Connor realizes that it isn't a grimace at all. It's a smile.
Chaos, man,
Cleaver says weakly.
Chaos. It's beautiful. Beautiful.
Connor doesn't know what to say to this. The man's delirious. He has to be.
It's okay,
Cleaver says.
This is an okay way to die. Better than suffocating, right?
Connor can only stare at him.
What? What did you say?
No one but Connor and the Admiral knew about the suffocations. Connor, the Admiral, and the one who did it.
You killed the Goldens! Hugh and Roland!
Roland, says Cleaver.
In spite of his pain, he actually seems insulted.
Roland's not one of us. He doesn't even know.
Cleaver catches the look on Connor's face and begins to laugh. Then the laugh becomes a rattle that resolves into a long, slow exhale. The grin never entirely leaves his face. His eyes stay open, but there's nothing in them. Just like his victim, Amp.
Oh, crap! He's dead, isn't he?
Says Hayden.
They killed him! Holy crap, they killed him!
Connor leaves the dead pilot in the dust and storms toward the Admiral's plane. He passes the infirmary along the way. Everything's been torn out of there as well.
Risa, where's Risa?
There are still kids all over the Admiral's jet. The tires have been slashed. Wing flaps lean at jagged angles, like broken feathers. The entire jet lists to one side.
Stop it!
Screams Connor.
Stop it now!
What are you doing? What have you done?
He reaches up to the wing, grabs a kid's ankle, and pulls him off onto the ground. But he can't do that to every single one of them. So he grabs a metal pole and smashes it against the wing over and over, the sound ringing out like a church bell, until their attention turns his way.
"Look at you!" he screams. "You've destroyed everything! How could you have done this? You should all be unwound! Every single one of you! You should all be unwound!"
It stops everyone. The kids on the wings, the kids at the bonfires. The shock of hearing such words from one of their own snaps them back to sanity. The shock of hearing his own words, and knowing that he meant them, frightens Connor almost as much as the scene before him. The rolling staircase leading to the Admiral's jet has fallen on its side.
"Over here," says Connor. "Help me with this."
A dozen kids, their fury spent, come running obediently. Together they right the stairs, and Connor climbs up to the hatch. He peers in the window. Connor can't see much. The Admiral's there on the floor, but he's not moving. If the Admiral can't get to the door, they'll never be able to get in. Wait, is that someone else in there with him? Suddenly a lever is thrown on the inside, and the hatch begins to swing open. The heat hits him instantly, a blast furnace of heat, and the face at the door is so red and puffy it takes a moment for him to realize who it is.
Risa?
She coughs and almost collapses into his arms, but manages to keep herself up.
"I'm okay,"
she says.
"I'm okay, but the Admiral..."
Together they go in and kneel beside him. He's breathing, but it's shallow and strained.
"It's the heat," says Connor,
and orders the kids lingering at the door to swing open every hatch.
"It's not just the heat," says Risa. "Look at his lips.
They're cyanotic, and his pressure is down to nothing."
Connor just stares at her, not comprehending.
"He's having a heart attack. I've been giving him CPR, but I'm not a doctor. There's only so much I can do."
My fault, says the Admiral. "My fault."
"Shh," says Connor. "You're going to be okay."
But Connor knows, just as he knew when he said it to Cleaver, the chances of that are slim. They carry the Admiral down the stairs, and as they do, the kids waiting outside back away, making room for him, as if it's already a coffin they're carrying. They set him down in the shade of the wing. Then kids around them begin to murmur.
"He killed the Goldens," someone says.
"The old man deserves what he gets."
Connor boils, but he's gotten much better at keeping his anger in check.
"Cleaver did it,"
Connor says forcefully enough for everyone to hear. That starts a murmur through the crowd until someone says,
"Yeah? Well, what about Emby?"
The Admiral's hand flutters up.
My son.
"Emby's his son?"
says one kid, and the rumor begins to spread through the crowd. Whatever the Admiral meant, it's lost now in incoherence as he slips in and out of consciousness.
"If we don't get him to a hospital, he'll die," says Risa,
giving him chest compressions once more. Connor looks around, but the closest thing to a car on the graveyard is the golf cart.
"There's the helicopter," says Hayden, "but considering the fact that the pilot's dead, I think we're screwed."
Risa looks at Connor. He doesn't need to read Risa for Morons to know what she's thinking. The pilot is dead, but Cleaver was training another one.
"I know what to do," says Connor. "I'll take care of it."
Connor stands up and looks around him. The smoke-stained faces, the smoldering bonfires. After today, nothing will be the same.
"Hayden," he says, "you're in charge. Get everything under control."
"You're kidding me, right?" Connor leaves Hayden to grapple with authority and finds three of the largest kids in his field of vision.
"You, you, and you," Connor says. "I need you to come with me to the FedEx jet."
The three kids step forward and Connor leads the way to Crate 2399 and Roland. This, Connor knows, will not be an easy conversation. 47. First Year Residence. In her 6 months working in the emergency room, the young doctor has seen enough strange things to fill her own medical school textbook. But this is the first time someone has crash-landed a helicopter in the hospital parking lot. She races out with a team of nurses, orderlies, and other doctors. It's a small private craft, 4-seater maybe. It's in one piece, and its blades are still spinning. It missed hitting a parked car by half a yard. Someone's losing their flying license. Two kids get out, carrying an older man in bad shape. There's already a gurney rolling out to meet them.
We have a rooftop helipad, you know.
He didn't think he'd be able to land on it, says the girl.
When the doctor looks at the pilot, still sitting behind the controls, she realizes that losing his license is not an issue. The kid at the controls can't be any older than 17. She hurries to the old man. A stethoscope brings barely a sound from his chest cavity. Turning to the medical staff around her, she says,
"Stabilize him and prep him for transplant."
Then she turns back to the kids.
"You're lucky you landed at a hospital with a heart bank, or we'd end up having to medevac him across town."
Then the man's hand rises from the gurney. He grabs her sleeve, tugging with more strength than a man in his condition should have.
"No transplant," he says.
"No, don't do this to me," thinks the doctor.
The orderlies hesitate.
"Sir, it's a routine operation."
"He doesn't want a transplant," says the boy.
"You brought him in from God knows where with an underage pilot to save his life, and he won't let us do it? We have an entire tissue locker full of healthy young hearts."
"No transplant," says the man.
"It's, against his religion," says the girl.
"Tell you what," says the boy. "Why don't you do whatever they did before you had a tissue locker full of healthy young hearts?" The doctor sighs. At least she's still close enough to medical school to remember what that is.
"It drastically lowers his chances of survival. You know that, don't you?"
He knows. She gives the man a moment more to change his mind, then gives up. The orderlies and other staff rush the man back toward the ER, and the two kids follow. Once they're gone, she takes a moment to catch her breath. Someone grabs her arm, and she turns to see the young pilot, who had been silent through all of it. The look on his face is pleading, yet determined. She thinks she knows what it's about. She glances at the helicopter, then at the kid.
"Take it up with the FAA," she says. "If he lives, I'm sure you'll be off the hook. They might even call you a hero."
"I need you to call the juvie cops," he says, his grip getting a little stronger.
"Excuse me?"
"Those two are runaway unwinds. As soon as the old man is admitted, they'll try to sneak away. Don't let them. Call the juvie cops now." She pulls out of his grip.
"All right, fine, I'll see what I can do."
"And when they come," he says, "make sure they talk to me first." She turns from him and heads back into the hospital, pulling out her cell phone on the way. If he wants the juvie cops, fine, he'll get them. The sooner they come, the sooner this whole thing can fall into the category of not my problem. 48. Risa. Juvie cops always look the same. They look tired, and they look angry. They look a lot like the unwinds they capture. The cop who now guards Risa and Connor is no exception. He sits blocking the door of the doctor's office they're being held in, with two more guards on the other side of the door just in case. He's content to stay silent, while another cop questions Roland in an adjacent room. Risa doesn't even want to guess at the topics of conversation in there.
"The man we brought in," Risa says. "How is he?"
"Don't know," says the cop. "You know hospitals. They only tell those things to next of kin. And I guess that's not you."
Risa won't dignify that with a response. She hates this juvie cop instinctively, just because of who he is and what he represents.
"Nice socks," Connor says.
The cop does not glance down at his socks. No show of weakness here.
"Nice ears," he says to Connor. "Mind if I try 'em on sometime?"
The way Risa sees it, there are two types of people who become juvie cops. Type one, bullies who want to spend their lives reliving their glory days of high school bullying. Type two, the former victims of type ones, who see every unwind as the kid who tormented them all those years ago. Type twos are endlessly shoveling vengeance into a pit that will never be full. Amazing that the bullies and victims can now work together to bring misery to others.
"How does it feel to do what you do?"
she asks him, sending kids to a place that ends their lives. Obviously, he's heard all this before.
"How does it feel to live a life no one else feels is worth living?"
It's a harsh blow designed to get her to shut up. It works. "I feel her life is worth living," says Connor, and he takes her hand. Anyone feel that way about you? It gets to the man, although he tries not to show it.
You both had more than 15 years to prove yourselves, and you didn't. Don't blame the world for your own lousy choices.
Risa can sense Connor's rage, and she squeezes his hand until she hears him take a deep breath and release it, keeping his anger under control.
Doesn't it ever occur to you, Unwinds, that you might be better off, happier even, in a divided state?
Is that how you rationalize it? Says Risa. Making yourself believe we'll be happier? Hey, if that's the case, says Connor, maybe everybody should get unwound. Why don't you go first?
The cop glares at Connor, then takes a quick glance down at his socks. Connor snickers. Risa closes her eyes for a moment, trying to see some ray of light in this situation, but she can't. She had known getting caught was a possibility when they came here. She knew that being out in the world was a risk. What surprised her was how quickly the juvie cops had descended on them. Even with their unorthodox entrance, they should have had enough time to slip away in the confusion. Whether the Admiral lives or dies, it won't change things for her or for Connor now. They are going to be unwound. All her hopes of a future have been torn away from her again, and having those hopes, even briefly, makes this far more painful than not having had them at all.
49. Roland. The juvie cop questioning Roland has eyes that don't exactly match and a sour smell, like his deodorant soap hadn't quite worked. Like his partner in the other room, the man is not easily impressed, and Roland, unlike Connor, doesn't have the wits to rattle him. That's all right, though, because rattling him is not what Roland has in mind. Roland's plan began to take shape shortly after Connor released him from the crate. He could have torn Connor limb from limb at the time, but Connor had 3 kids equal in size and strength to Roland to back him up. They were kids who should have been on Roland's side. Should have been. It was his first indication that everything had drastically changed. Connor told him about the riot and about Cleaver. He offered a lame apology for accusing him of killing the Goldens, an apology that Roland refused to accept. Had Roland been at the riot, it would have been organized and successful. If he had been there, it would have been a revolt, not a riot. By locking Roland away, Connor had robbed him of the chance to lead. When they had arrived back at the scene of the riot, all focus was on Connor. All questions were directed to him. He was telling everyone what to do, and they were all listening. Even Roland's closest friends cast their eyes down when they saw him. He instinctively knew that all his support was gone. His absence from the disaster had made him an outlaw.